Hello. In this audio snippet, we're going to begin to talk about the 10th pillar of the new American Constitution, which is the right to a personal domain. And before we get into that pillar in particular, I'd like to share a couple of separate thoughts. First, I felt led to share a comment that I read online on a conservative website that was reporting on a story about a Latin American president who commented on Twitter, if I'm not mistaken, that he was saddened about how America was destroying herself from within. And he was responding to some story about how shelves in a certain Rite Aid store, there's a chain of stores in the New York area called Rite Aid. I'm not sure if they are if they're a national chain, but I know that they are very common in the New York area, and especially in New York. And for some reason, I've never gone into one. And I there's something about those stores that tells me to stay away. Like, I don't want to go in there. There's something wrong with it. I'm not sure exactly what that might be. But the thing is that it's a very popular store, chain of stores. And one or more of those stores has empty shelves and is about to close because of all the shoplifting that has been going on because of the lax laws that the bastard ex-mayor of New York enabled. So criminals have been emboldened in New York City. And so they just go into stores now, apparently, and just shoplift because they know that they're not going to be prosecuted. Or if they get caught, they'll just be released without bail. So this is causing some stores to close. And this Latin American president was reacting to that story and, interestingly enough, made that comment about how America is so sadly destroying herself and why is she doing that, considering that previously America had these wonderful, great cities, and now they are no more because of the self-destruction going on. And it's kind of sad that it takes a Latin American president to make that comment. And there's something peculiar about this fellow in particular. But he seems to have a certain enlightenment, a certain understanding about things. And so he made this comment, and this was posted on this news site. And people started making comments about that story at the bottom. And it was interesting to me that no one or very few people actually congratulated the president, this Latin American president, for making this comment. Instead, they just started criticizing him. It was very odd. But the comment that drew my attention and that made me feel even more frustrated than I normally do is a comment that reads as follows. I copy-pasted it, and it said, if the Founding Fathers saw society in this country as it currently stands, what would they do? Seems they would acknowledge the country's already lost and want to start over. So on the surface, it looks like a reasonable comment talking about, you know, how the country has fallen apart. But what saddens me about the comment is this notion that the Founding Fathers, created this country, and now it's falling apart, and they would be so disappointed at the current state of things, and that things are so bad that they would, that their opinion would more than likely be, oh, we need to start all over again. But I really don't know exactly. I can't say with 100% certainty where this comment was heading or what the person who wrote this was really thinking at the end of the day. But it would seem from the little that was posted in that one comment that this person was saying that the founding fathers, in their brilliance, built this wonderful house, and the people who've come to live in it have destroyed it. And now it seems as if we need to, tear down the house and build it again. But obviously, if it's the founding fathers who are saying we need to start over, it's like this person is saying we have to rebuild the house the way the founding fathers thought it was supposed to be. In other words, it goes back to the same thing that we keep repeating in these audio clips over and over again about how America is so stupid that we've gone through 2 years at the time of this recording of all this destruction going on, and this is just the climax of a ongoing destruction that has gone on for decades, and it has reached its climax, you could say, in these last couple of years. And we've gone through this hell, and we still haven't learned a thing, a single thing, from this whole experience. We haven't understood that we have a flawed system, that we need to recognize that the founding fathers, well-intentioned as they may have been, did a lot of stupid things, made a lot of stupid decisions in the way they built the foundation of the country. And that's why we are in the state we're in. It was just inevitable. Eventually, we were going to get to this. But instead of us understanding that, that we need to rethink everything with that we did, all we are want to do is go back to the past and start all over in the sense of repeating the same things again. So it's like we learned nothing. Just like, for example, the disappointment in my heart at hearing that Donald Trump has 130 million already, or some large amount. I can't remember the exact amount, but a bunch of money already accumulated in donations for a future run that he's saying, he will run again in 2024. So it's like people saw what he did for 4 years, saw how he was duped over and over and over again, how he was the one who enabled Tony Fauci to say all these lies and promulgate all this unscientific nonsense. After he allowed these lethal injections that are so-called vaccines that are being spread all over the world, that he was the one who enabled all of this, made it possible. He accelerated the production of it, and even to this day is proud of having done that. And after all of that, after he supposedly, trusted Miguelito Pence, and then Pence betrayed him, when, as I was sharing with some people who have followed the website where these audio clips are posted, know that even from 2016, we were saying Miguelito Pence is a traitor. And you can look it up. There's a posting from November 28th, 2016, where at the end of that posting, we say it in blatant, clear words: Miguelito Pence is a traitor. And we all were saying that before in tweets when we used to use Twitter years ago. So we knew, and the people who were watching and observing knew that he was a traitor and people like him were a traitor. Yet he, after 4 years, only found out until the end. So we have this person with this track record of failure over and over and over again. And instead of us realizing, hey, this guy is a fool, let's not elect a person like that again. Let's look and clamor for someone who has a higher view of things, a clearer view of things. Instead of that, we just want to go back to the same thing over and over again. So that's so disheartening to see our American stupidity just continuing unrelentingly despite everything that's going on. The stubbornness and stupidity is just mind-boggling. And so that was one thing. And the second thing we wanted to share was a little more about this fellow that we mentioned in passing in the previous audio clip, the fellow by the name of Governor Morris. And we mentioned him in the context of a landmark case where there was this trial, this lawsuit of a governor of New York who was suing a publisher for libel because he published some things that were not very flattering about the governor. And even though they were true, according to the law at the time, the governor had the right to win the lawsuit, but the jury decided in favor of the publisher because they knew that it was unfair to punish the publisher for publishing something that was true about the governor. And Governor Morris said that this was like the spark, the beginning of the lighting of the torch of freedom. I'm paraphrasing what he was saying, but that he saw this as a very important moment in American history where we believe that truth trumped over social values or traditions or hierarchies, that the truth was more important than all these things. And he was right, that was a very important moment. And we wanted to mention that this fellow, Governor Morris, actually was the one who wrote the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. He was in the Constitutional Convention, and he was the one appointed to lead the effort to write this preamble. And what he wrote, I don't know if he was the one who wrote it himself or he led the group that wrote it, who drafted it, I'm not sure. But basically the preamble says, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Very eloquent phrasing. And a lot of people say this is basically the sentence encapsulates the intent of the Constitution. And they are right, because as you can see at the beginning, it says, in order to form a more perfect union. So that kind of encapsulates the thinking of all the people in the Constitutional Convention of 1787 in Philadelphia. They wanted to unite the states, the colonies, into one nation to form a more perfect union. And more perfect, many people believe, and I believe, is a kind of a subtle reference to the Articles of Confederation, which was the document, you could say, that united the colonies before the U.S. Constitution, but because it was so weak, there was a need to change to a new document. And that's what the Constitution is mostly about, uniting these states that were for the most part their own entities. And the sad thing, in a sense, when you read this statement, when it says, it says some good things: establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense. So it's always like, okay, thinking about a nation. We're forming a nation out of these states, these disparate states, and then promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. And unfortunately, the concept of liberty there is collective, to ourselves and our posterity. So it's saying, in a sense, protecting our liberty from foreign occupation or foreign control. It doesn't say that, but it's kind of subtly mentioned in that phrase. And then it says, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. but there is really no reference to the liberty of the individual. And that's part of the problem of the Constitution, that it's a document intended to unite states, leaving states a sovereignty they should not have under this federalist system, and instead of focusing on the right of the one individual, and that's the foundation for everything else. But what we wanted to mention is that this fellow, Governor Morris, was very important. He was the one who wrote this. And another thing that's important to know about this fellow is that he was one of the few delegates at the Philadelphia Convention of 1787 who spoke openly against slavery. So while all these other people were just trying to put together a document that kind of united all these disparate states that wanted to have it their way, while everybody else was thinking about that, at least Governor Morris was thinking, hey, we have to talk about this slavery thing. It's not right to just let it be. And according to James Madison, who was like taking notes during the convention, James Madison wrote that Morris spoke against slavery on the 8th of August in 1787. And that's interesting, the 8th day of the 8th month of 1787, saying that it was incongruous to say that a slave was both a man and property at the same time. So in the notes that Madison wrote, he said that Morris never would concur in upholding domestic slavery, that it was a nefarious institution, that it was the curse of heaven on the state where it prevailed. Compare the free regions of the middle states, where rich and noble cultivation marks the prosperity and happiness of the people, with the misery and poverty which overspread the barren wastes of Virginia, Maryland, and the other states having slaves. And proceed southwardly, and every step you take through the great regions of slaves presents a desert increasing with the increasing proportion of these wretched beings. So, and it's a very powerful statement that Governor Morris was making. He was saying, look at the free states. There's progress, there's prosperity, there's peace. Look at the southern states and you see poverty, you see wretchedness, you see barrenness. And that is true even to this day. If you go to the south in the United States, it's mostly rural throughout. It's that curse of having allowed slavery to be there, and to this day to still kind of silently not repent of it, in the sense of not acknowledging before God, before man, before everyone, saying, hey, we sinned against the truth. We sinned against humanity by having done this. We repent. If we could do a mulligan and could do it all over again, we would never repeat the things we did. Instead, we all just take this attitude, oh, you know, it's just part of our history, blah, 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 blah. That's just the way it was. And we worked it out. There are no more slaves. So what's the big deal? And that just won't cut it. So that curse remains over that whole region of the United States, the South, because you wonder, you know, there's a lot of good things about the South and their values and a lot of healthy qualities about people of the South. And then you go, why is there so much, why don't they have the progress, the industrial prowess of states like New York or New Jersey or California or places like that, even, you know, places where there are a lot of people doing a lot of destruction, a lot of evil, and even so, there's a certain level of prosperity, and you wonder how can they prosper in any way compared to these healthier people of the South. And the thing is, because that curse is still hanging over that region of the country. And you can see that curse is there by the fact that people get offended when statues of Robert E. Lee, you know, get defaced or criticized or attacked, when Robert E. Lee should be a symbol of Robert E. Lee was a bastard, a worthless bastard. Oh, he might have been a good general, but yeah, you know, just like Mengele must have been a good doctor. It really does not matter how smart he was military strategist. He was fighting for evil, even though he was not, you know, pro-slavery in the radical sense of the word. He fought for a system that was intent on and stubbornly intent on preserving the bondage of black people in America. He fought for that, and he fought for 5 years, and he used his military abilities to drag out this war and give the South this idea that they could actually succeed in upholding this evil institution. So how can we put up a statue to honor such a stupid man, an evil man? He could have sided with the Union. He could have fought for the Union against the South. But no, oh, I'm from the South and, you know, I must honor my state. I think he was from Virginia. I forget what state he was from, but he was from a southern state, and he decided, I'm going to honor my people and my state. And instead of believing in the truth, he sided with evil. And that evil, instead of being seen with shame and sorrow, is upheld and put up in a pedestal in statues. You see, how can there be a statue of Jefferson Davis, you know, the president of the Confederate States of America? How can there be a statue honoring that son of a bitch? How can there be a statue honoring that bastard boy? That's like having a statue in Munich honoring Hitler. How can you do that? So the South has never really repented collectively as a region. Has never repented of what it did. It just looks back as, oh yeah, whatever, we had to do it. Someone had to harvest the crops and they were there, and then, you know, slavery kind of somehow ended, and then we moved on. No. You can't do that. And that's why that curse remains over the South. And as long as there's no awareness of that, what Morris said in 1787, I mean, how long ago was that? That's about 235 years ago. And his words are still lingering as a curse over that whole region of the country. And then he also said, upon what principle is it that the slaves should be computed in the representation? Are they men? Then make them citizens and let them vote. Are they property? Why then is no other property included? The houses in this city of Philadelphia are worth more than all the wretched slaves which cover the rice swamps of South Carolina. So what he was saying was that, you know, as you know, at the end of the day, the Constitution writers decided that in southern states, slaves counted as 3/5 of a person. When it came to calculating how the population representation for each state. So obviously a state that had a bigger population had a right to more representatives in the House of Representatives. So southern states wanted to include slaves as part of the population, because if they included the slaves, then they'd have more people in Congress representing southern interests. But the people of the North didn't want that, especially, you know, the few who were against slavery. And then they did the compromise, the stupid thing that Americans do all the time, you know, this pragmatic compromising, so that, you know, because we're not a people of principle, we're a practical people. So we decided, okay, let's compromise. It's going to be 3/5. And then but Governor Morris was saying, hey, you know, it's either or. Because, and by the way, one thing that angers me when liberals, you know, go to the Constitution and say, hey, look, these founding fathers were racist because they said that a black man was worth 3/5 of a white man. And they see it as a sign of how evil they were. So, in other words, if they had said that a black man was worth 1/5 of a person when it came to calculating the representation in Congress, according to these idiot liberals, that would have been even more racist. And these stupid liberal sons of bitches who are so ignorant in their understanding. And when I say sons of bitches, I'm referring to their attitude. A bitch is a female dog in English. And as you know, that and when I use that word, that's what I'm referring to. The female dog represents a certain mindset, certain attitude. And that's why they are sons of bitches. It's not just a vulgar term of derision against them. So these sons of bitches don't understand that... the lower that number was, the less representation the evil Southern states, slave states, had in Congress. It was a way to protect them because, as Mars was saying, if they are citizens, then let them vote. You know, it's one man, one vote. Then equate them with the white man and allow them to vote. Otherwise, if you're going to keep them as slaves. And you're saying, because they are property, they count as must count as something. Then he said, if property increases your representation, then why not include your house too? Why not include your carriage and your horses? That's what he was saying. So he was giving a metaphysical judgment on what was being done. That this is stupid. Yeah, it's a compromise, but it's a compromise. That clearly is not anywhere near the truth because it is self-contradictory. But Governor Morris was a man of principle. He was not a man of pragmatism. He was a man of principle, and he unfortunately, was not heeded, was not listened to in the things that he said. So he said the admission of slaves into the representation, when fairly explained, comes to this, that the inhabitant of Georgia and South Carolina who goes to the coast of Africa and in defiance of the most sacred laws of humanity tears away his fellow creatures from their dearest connections and damns them to the most cruel bondages shall have more votes in a government instituted for protection of the rights of mankind than the citizens of Pennsylvania or New Jersey who view with a laudable horror so nefarious a practice. So he was saying, so you're by giving the Southern states 3/5 or whatever percentage of additional representation for every black slave they owned, you're giving them more representation on account of them holding slaves, on account of them doing these horrible practices. That actually, you're rewarding that. That's basically what he's saying. And saying, and you're doing that in a system that is designed, that he said, instituted for the protection of the rights of mankind. So he's saying, we are doing something that's very self-contradictory here. And someone should stand up and take notice. And unfortunately, no one did. Only Governor Morris did. And I just wanted to mention him, that he... So he's a very important person in American history. But sadly, he was not heeded enough. And now we are where we are. People of principle like him... have been ignored throughout the decades in America. So now that we've done this very short preamble to what we really wanted to talk about, let's go ahead and talk about the 10th pillar of the New American Constitution, which is the right to a personal domain. And the question becomes, what do we mean by that? And the right to a personal domain refers to loosely said, the right to establish many kingdoms where your will predominates. In other words, that you as a human being, as an individual, you have the right to establish a kingdom, like a mini kingdom around you, where your will is the one that predominates over the wills of others, or what others might want to have happen. And an example of that would be, for example, your home. You should be, as the old saying goes, the king of your castle. In other words, you should be that once when you're in your house, you should be free to decide what color your house is. Obviously, we're not considering a case where you're renting and you have to abide by the landlord's rules that you cannot paint the flat or the apartment without the person's consent. But because in that case, the landlord is the lord of that domain. But even even if you're not the landlord, as a tenant, you do have certain rights to exercise a certain liberty on how your flat, how your apartment looks and feels. And if you're denied that, even if you can't decide what color your walls will be, if you're constrained to an extreme level, then your right to a personal domain is being violated. But the thing is that we all have the right to have a space where we decide how things go. You know, if you want the television set here in this corner, or if you want it there, it's your choice, it's your house. And this is different from the concept of a right to privacy. So we're not, because the right to privacy is your right to a space where you can be vulnerable. Where you can walk around in your underwear, you know, that's in a state of vulnerability. That's the right to privacy. This is different. This is the right to have a space where other people might come in at any time, but when they come in, they know this is this person's domain. And this person decides how things are. You can't go into another person's house and say, hey, you should put the sofa over there because it doesn't look good over here. You may want to give your opinion about it, but you can't force the other person to put the sofa over there because it's their house. It's their personal domain, and they get to decide where that sofa is. And even if they are very bad decorators and they're putting it in the worst possible place, and everybody knows that it's the most stupid place to put the sofa in, it does not matter. It's their house, and they have the right as individuals to decide where that sofa will be. So that's more or less what we're referring to. Another example of a personal domain, a common example, is a business. So we as human being, and this is very important in relation to the concept of capitalism, that we as human beings have the right to start a business and to have relative freedom on what business we start. We don't have to be told by the state, okay, you're going to be a carpenter, you're going to be a surgeon, you're going to be this. No, if I want to, you know, start a law firm, that's my prerogative, and I should have the freedom to go into that. And once I start that business, I have the right to give it the name I want. I have the right to decide what type of speciality I will follow. And things like that. So we should have that freedom to start a business, and within that business, we can decide the rules. We can decide, okay, the structure of the business is going to be like this. There's going to be this position and this position, and you can define the hierarchy of the company any way you want, and so forth. So those are examples of a personal domain. And if you can't have the right to do that, then your right to that fifth fundamental human right, or the 10th pillar of the Constitution, is being violated. So there's also a personal domain like a social club. If you want to start a social club and you want to define the rules of how that social club operates, you should have relative freedom in that regard. If you want to start a social club for people who like Star Trek, then that's your prerogative, and you can set the rules that, you know, whoever joins this club has to be able to do the Vulcan salute with the fingers, which I can't do, you know, that thing where you have a space between your fingers, with two fingers on each side. I can't do that with my hand. But if I want to start a social club, or somebody wants to start a club like that and says, no, no one can join this club unless they can do the Vulcan sign with their hands, you know, it's their prerogative. Because we as human beings have the right to be kings. And I say kings in the masculine, but this applies to men and women. But we have the right to be kings and to exercise kingship and establish a kingdom, a mini kingdom, where we decide, where our will has is predominant in certain ways. And that kingdom can encompass other people, people who willingly join and become part of that kingdom. You know, just like when a person starts a business and starts hiring people, people willingly, voluntarily join that kingdom. And once, and as you know, once when you get hired by a company, you more or less are agreeing to a certain level that, you know, you're not the boss. They are making decisions. And sometimes they will make decisions that you will not agree with, and they might be completely wrong, but it's their business and you're working for them. And as long as you're not, you know, compromising your principles, your core principles, you will go ahead and basically do what you're being told to do. Like, for example, if you're hired as a gardener and you're being told to rake the leaves from one side of the garden to the other all day, and that's all you're getting paid to do, you know, that's the most stupid way to use your time. You could be using it doing other things, but if that's what you're being told, you'll have to do that. And if you don't agree, you have the right to quit and find some other job. So there's a certain prerogative that we as individuals should be allowed to have. And we have to respect that right to a personal domain. No one can come and say, I don't like it, and I'm going to impose something else on you. If it's going to violate my right to a personal domain, my right to be a king in my space, then you can't do it. But that's more or less the basic concept of what the right to a personal domain is. And it's important to point out that this pillar, this fifth human right, is the fundamental pillar from which the right to vote emanates. This is very important, as we've shared before, that the system that we need to build for the new nation, the new American nation, built on this new American Constitution, this system has to be mathematical in its nature. And we've shared before, for example, with Euclid and Euclidean geometry. Those of you who studied it in high school or at university know that Euclid, this Greek guy who lived a long time ago, he one day sat down and said, I'm going to define these postulates. And he defined 23, I think it was, postulates, and saying, okay, I'm just going to assume this to be true. And like the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. I don't remember if that's one of the actual postulates. It's been so long, but let's say it is. So he just said, I'm going to state this as a truth, and a postulate is something that is so fundamental that you just have to accept it as true. There's no need to prove it to be true. You just know it's true. So he wrote these postulates down, these 23 things that he said, these are our core principles. And then out of that, he built an entire geometry. So what he would do is start combining postulates. And through logic, postulates would combine into lemmas, and lemmas into axioms or lemmas, and then you would start building theorems, like more complex truths out of these fundamental blocks of truth. So every truth that you can derive in Euclidean geometry has to be traced back eventually to one or more of the postulates at the beginning of the geometry, you could say. And that's the same thing. Every law that any Congress person produces should somehow be traced to one or more of the 10 pillars that we are describing. If you can't trace it to any of these things, then it must not be true. Because everything has to be mathematical. We establish a law, these laws and principles, and then we build on the things we hold to be true, and we build new truths. And that's how we develop our legal system. So it's important to mention the right to vote. It's not just something that someone makes up after the fact. No, it has to be the result of one of the fundamental principles. And if we know the right to vote should exist, but we can't trace it to a pillar, then that means one of two things. Either the right to vote really isn't a right, or we are missing a pillar. And what I want to mention here is that the right to vote emanates from this pillar that we're discussing right now. And why? Because we as a human beings have a right to be king, but the problem is we can't all be kings over everybody else. Otherwise, we'd have anarchy, you know. So there has to be an authority system that we all have to somehow agree to in a certain way. And in the old days, we had absolute monarchies where there was this monarch who was divinely appointed somehow. He was born into the position, and that was proof that it was from God. And he decided everything for everybody else. And we slowly moved away from that. And we began to realize, no, the individual is the core. Everyone has the same value, inherent value. We lose the value through our behavior, but that's another story. But we all start off with an inherent equal value. And as equal beings, we have the right to be kings, to establish a kingship, to have a certain authority over how our lives will go. So because of that, then we have the right to have an influence on how the government's going to be shaped. And therein comes the right to vote, because it emanates from our kingship. Our individual kingship gives us the right and the authority to have a say on how the government that will ultimately, you know, produce the rules, the laws that we are forced to live under, will be formed. And so that was an important comment. And also, as a side note, I felt it was very important to once again make the point about this difference between a democracy and a republic. And conservatives always brag about the fact that the founding fathers founded a republic, it's not a democracy, and blah, blah, blah. And they do have a point to a certain extent, but they don't realize that as they're saying that, they're exposing a fundamental problem with the way the founding fathers viewed the world. Democracy is basically a pure democracy would be where everything is voted on, and that's how everything is decided, whether it is true or false. That's pure democracy in a very ambiguous nutshell. And a republic is a system where you have representatives, where you have a structure deciding things. And it has kind of the basic assumption that there's a constitution that everybody has to live under, but there's also the concept of representation. So you elect people to represent you, and then they decide the laws that will be applied on you. And supposedly they will do it under the restriction of a constitution. And when people say, oh, or a democracy, a pure democracy is evil because it's the tyranny of the majority, they're saying, hey, it's a system. A pure democracy is a system where people just decide the laws by pure majority. So the majority will start oppressing the minority, and the minority have nothing to defend themselves by. And that a republic provides that because it has a constitution. But I would dare say that the difference between a democracy and a republic is that when you lean towards a republic, you're leaning towards the delegation of responsibility of legislation. It's like you're saying, I'm not going to decide, I'm just going to elect someone who is brighter than me, who will decide for me, because I'm too busy running my business and I'm too stupid to think on laws and conflicts, things like that. So I'll leave it to the masters. So I'll just vote in the masters and they will decide how to run my life. And so there's a bit of elitism. So when you start hearing someone say, oh, it's a republic, not a democracy, your spidey senses should start tingling, and you should start recognizing you're listening to an elitist, a person who thinks that you should delegate the important stuff to people who are more important than you. And that is absolutely wrong. The reason why we need a republic in the sense of representation is practicality. That's it. It's not because, that would create a tyranny. No, we can have a constitution with a pure democracy. We could have a system where every law is decided we have a computer system and somebody proposes a law and we all punch in, our vote. Like American Idol, and then suddenly we decide, okay, this is the law of the land. And we have a constitution over it, a system that says, hey, this law was voted in, but it's unconstitutional. Then we still have a pure democracy and a constitution protecting us from bad laws. But we still have that with a republic. It's the same thing. But instead of the whole population voting, it's the people in Congress. And even that is not very well defined in the current system. We have what they call judicial review, the power of the judicial branch to strike down a law because it's unconstitutional. And that's not in the Constitution. Judicial review is not in the Constitution. And anybody who says that to you is either lying or ignorant, because it's not there. But people say, oh, it's kind of implicitly there, we've accepted it. No, but it's either there or not there. Don't play with me. It's either there or not there. The fact that it's not there is one more evidence of how empty and vacuous the Constitution is in many areas. It's just has so many holes that and that's been the problem. That how the judicial review process should operate has never been well defined. So we have a republic where people are voting for us, elect, and look at where it has gotten us $30 trillion in debt. That's we've crossed the $30 trillion mark recently, and that's not including the unfunded liabilities, which would take us into the hundreds of trillions of dollars, literally. So we are in the red, and under a representative democracy or republic, with judges who, activist judges, who are fulfilling, filling a vacuum that it needs to be filled, but they're filling it in an exaggerated way. I mean, but we do need a system where the judges can step in and strike down a law. But what happens if a bad judge strikes down a good law? Who can stop that? No one. No one, because the system, the Constitution, doesn't say anything on how to do that. And that's part of what we will discuss, hopefully, in a future audio clip. But the thing is that we democracy is the core. We need representatives out of practical reasons. We have a population of 300 million people. We can't be, having to get a vote from 300 million people on every issue. It'd just be too impractical. It's just for practical reasons that we need representation, and we need the ability to put people in representation of us in a way that truly reflects what the democracy, the people are saying. And we don't have that now. Republic, Shmulek, what's the point of what we have right now if the people who are there are not truly a representation of what we as a people think? And the reason why we don't have that right now is because we have the party system. and we have to destroy the party system. As we've said before, no one in the House of Commons, you know, the new House of Representatives and the new unicameral Congress or legislative branch, no one in the new House of Commons will be affiliated to a party. There is no majority, no party holding the majority and then deciding who's the speaker and then deciding who is the chairman of what committee. It'd be a purely democratic system. We said that anyone can propose a bill at any time, and only the bills that get the most upvotes then go to the floor and then they get voted on. There's no one holding them back through these elitist blood clot, power clot positions. It has to be very democratic, very democratic. No elitism, no committee where, you know, the experts on foreign affairs decide whether a bill looks reasonable enough. No. Let the people, in this case, the entire House of Commons, decide whether this bill is reasonable. Don't let these elitists, experts within the House, decide. Because who becomes the expert? The one who kisses the most butt. That's the one who becomes the expert on foreign affairs and becomes the chairman of the Committee of on Foreign Affairs or whatever, and then gets to decide whether a bill on foreign affairs is, should ever be voted on. So we don't. We should have democracy. This worship of the Republican system should be destroyed. We should love and embrace full democracy within the House of Commons and within our people. We should also have the possibility of people voting the way they do in California, for example. That's one of the few good things about California, where people can vote. They put things on the ballot, like Proposition 8 or whatever, and they say, you know, they say, do you want this to be done? And people vote yes or no. There should be more of that. The embracing of people being kings and as part of this 10th pillar of the of the Constitution. Having said all of that, it's important to mention that no personal domain can be ruled with absolute will. In other words, there's no absolute monarchy in these domains. You cannot say, I will violate the right of another person. Like if somebody comes into your house, yeah, they can't tell you where to put your sofa or where to put that painting or what paintings to buy and what paintings to hang on your walls. They can't do that. But that doesn't give you the right to then, you know, like take out a gun and shoot them and say, hey, you know, I'm going to kill you if you do anything that displeases me while you're in my house. Even if it's your house, even if it's your mini kingdom, it does not give you absolute right to violate that person's right to life or say, hey, you come into my house, I can rob you. I can, you know, take your wallet and take your jewelry and rob you blind because you're inside my house. You can't do that. So there's no absolute will. So the right to a personal domain does not mean that you can violate the rights of others. And that like associated to that, there's this like a second concept that's kind of the same, another side of the same coin, and that is that you must respect the inherent equality of all people. Within your personal domain, you respect others. Like you are the king of that castle, of that domain, but even as a king, you are an equal to the person that you're a king over for a second, you know, while that person is in your kingdom. He is an equal to you. And so you respect his equality, his inherent equality. And therefore, even though you're in a position of power, of kingship, you still are required to respect the value of that person because that person is inherently equal to you. So those are important things to keep in mind regarding this pillar. So now that we've said that, let's start the beginning. And time is running out, but let's begin the complex discussion of the boundaries of our personal domain. It gets very complicated. And I think this pillar is probably the most complex of all. The right to privacy is the most murky to me, the most murky of all the rights. It's very ambiguous and it's very difficult to kind of see through the fog. But this right, more than murky or foggy, is very complex, very difficult to discern, to make out, because it's inherently very, very complicated. And if we can get this pillar right in the New American Constitution, we are set. This 10th pillar is kind of the clincher, the one that will guarantee that we will have a fair system going forward. But to do that, we have to kind of think through a lot of examples, like do these thought experiments and analyze how our understanding of this pillar applies in different circumstances. So let's take a first example. And some of you who are familiar with things that go on in America might have heard of a story some years ago about a baker, I think in Colorado, I'm not sure, somebody had a family, had a bakery, and they were or are, if they're still alive, haven't taken the injection. They were Christians, and apparently, I don't know if this was done on purpose, because sometimes these people do this just for the hell of it, and literally, I mean hell of it. Two homosexuals showed up at the bakery, and they requested that the baker prepare a wedding cake for them, for their homosexual wedding. And the bakers, the people, you know, the family said, no, I can't do that because we're Christians and we don't believe in homosexual marriage, and out of our principle, we can't bake a cake, a wedding cake for you. And then all hell broke loose. I think they sued, or I forget what happened, but and these bakers got threatened, and all hell broke loose, and that brought up the question that the bakers have the right to deny these homosexuals a cake for their wedding. And was this discrimination? Was this, some form of bigotry and treating these people like they're not equals and whatever? And on the conservative side, people say, okay, this is a question of religious beliefs, and I have the freedom of religion, and blah 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 blah. But to me, And I hope you understand what I'm about to say. And I think this is very important. And I'm not saying just what I think is in my opinion. I believe this is the absolute truth, what I'm about to try to explain. That when people start using the word religion to kind of justify certain behaviors and say, okay, this is the umbrella, we can put this behavior under this umbrella to justify it legally or morally or whatever, what they're doing is being very, very, very lazy. Because the problem with religion, the concept of religion is a way to protect certain behaviors, is that if you think about it, it can get very, very, it can deteriorate very quickly. It can get very bad very quickly. For example, if I believe in a religion, and I sincerely believe in a religion where it's important to kill a cat every 3 days, I just have to, it's just part of it, it's part of the ritual. The gods that I worship require a cat every 3 days for some odd reason, and I just have to do it. Then I go around killing cats, and if I can, you know, break into a house and catch a cat, some pet, and take it and kill it, or maybe I catch them as they are wandering in their owner's backyard, and I lure them with some, you know, some tuna or whatever, and then I grab them and then I kill them. And then I let's say the cat owners, you know, sue me because, you know, I killed their cat. And then I go, hey, that's my religion. And you're denying me the right to practice my religion. Then, you know, you'd go, no, I couldn't care less what your religion is. I you can't, you just can't do that. So religion quickly can deteriorate into this very ambiguous cover for practically anything. So what if I have a religion that where I believe that black people are inherently inferior to whites, and therefore, you know, if a black person comes into my bakery, I will not bake a cake for them because my religion says that I will commit a sin if I bake a cake for a black person. You know, that's a religion. And how can you say, no, you don't have the right to practice that religion? Well, freedom of religion requires that you allow them to practice, to believe that. Well, yeah, but if I carry out my belief, then I will be discriminating against black people. But if we allow this lazy canopy of religion to be a way to explain things, then well, we would have to accept that behavior and say, hey, yeah, he has, in his religion, black people are scum of the earth, and I'm not going to bake a cake for them. And if you think that is nonsense, a nonsense example, just think of what happens in India, even to this day. In India, you have untouchables, people who are believed to be of a lower caste, and it's a religious thing because it's believed to be a metaphysical truth. And I don't know exactly how they justify that certain people are untouchables. They're just born inferior, maybe because they used to be cockroaches in a past life. I have no idea how they decide that or what their metaphysical justification is. But it is religious in its nature, saying these people are born inherently inferior. And because they're inherently inferior, the ones who are not untouchables just won't touch them or get near them, like, ooh, you know, and if they feel that their religious beliefs are violated, if you force them to touch an untouchable, so that's why the religion thing is a very iffy thing. And if anyone starts talking religion to me, it's like, okay, I'm talking to a person with a very low level of understanding, a person who speaks at a very simplistic level. So we cannot build a foundation of a legal or life foundation or truth foundation on the concept of religion. It just does not work. Because at the end of the day, everyone has a religion. Everyone. Even the atheist has a religion. And what I mean by religion is a belief in things you cannot see. Everyone believes in things they cannot see. Everyone. Even the person who's a materialist. Because if you ask a materialist, okay, so you don't believe in the things you can't touch. Okay, so to you, that's a truth you live by. Things that cannot be perceived with the physical senses do not exist. Okay, that means that he believes in this idea. And then I would ask him, can you touch that idea? Is that idea tangible? The idea that only what you can touch or you can perceive or measure exists. And as you can see, it's self-contradictory. Just like when you, for example, ask a relativist, a person who believes that there's no absolute truth, just ask him, are you absolutely sure that there's no absolute truth? And if they say, yes, I'm absolutely sure there's no absolute truth, he just stated an absolute truth in his system that contradicts the idea that that there is no absolute truth. So everybody believes in something. Everybody. The concept that there is no invisible thing is in itself invisible. So everybody lives by ideas. Just look at liberals. Liberals are anti-religion, quote unquote, as you can find in the world. They are anti-religious, but they act with the zealotry of religious fanatics. like, oh, you have to wear your mask. Oh, you have to get the injection, or you are a danger to society. Danger, danger, danger. These are religious fanatics. They act like religious self-righteous fanatics, even though they don't have the word religion in their ideology, but they are religious zealots. You can present all the facts, all the science, all the information to them, and because it's against their ideology, they will reject it, just like a religious nut. So everybody has a, quote, religion. Religion is just your belief system. Everybody has a belief system. Everybody believes in something. And if you don't believe in anything, then you believe that nothing should be believed. So hence, you believe in something. Everybody believes in something. And we act by these ideas and principles that we cannot see. Everyone does. So just to say, oh, I am practicing my religion and that we should respect people's religion is an empty, vacuous statement. And people who talk like that are lazy people. And conservatives are about as lazy as you can get. They are swamp people. As we've said before, the true swamp in America is conservatism. Stagnation. Just status quo. Conserve the status quo. So we're going to be talking more, because we've run out of time, about this, and try to kind of get to the root of the boundaries of the right to a personal domain. And we'll continue talking about this Baker example, and then give other examples. And as we give these examples and think them out, we're going to hopefully fish out principles. And then we can put all these principles together and hopefully have a good definition of what the right to a personal domain must look like. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening.